Bond, 18 community publications and growing. NewsAtomic.com.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, an update on the status of local vaccinations with Dr. Bruce Elswick, Sullivan County Medical Director. Make your cake a canvas. We chat with award-winning Food Network cake artist Kim Simons. And later, the student journalists of Manor, Inc. bring us some of their stories, including a look at an ancient Korean martial art form folks are practicing right here at Liberty. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Amy Held. Next week, Congress takes on infrastructure work. President Biden is spending the weekend in Delaware, where he once would catch the Amtrak train into Washington. He hit the rails again yesterday, this time at 30th Street Station in Philadelphia, to pitch his $2.3 trillion infrastructure plan.
Transit is part of the infrastructure. And like the rest of our infrastructure, we're way behind the rest of the world right now.
His plan includes spending on roads, rails, bridges, and broadband. Republican lawmakers say it's too sprawling. Georgia's attorney general, a Republican, is declining to represent the state's top election official accused of trying to interfere with the 2020 presidential election results in the state. Johnny Kaufman from member station WABE has more.
In the aftermath of the 2020 election, former President Donald Trump called Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, pressuring him to find enough votes to change the results. A prosecutor in Fulton County then launched a criminal investigation into the matter. Trump also reportedly reached out to Georgia Attorney General Chris Carr at the time, urging him not to oppose a Texas lawsuit seeking to throw out Georgia's election results. Carr's decision to not represent Raffensperger's office in the probe has prompted Governor Brian Kemp to appoint a special counsel to represent the state. Carr's office did not respond to requests for comment. A spokesperson for Raffensperger welcomed the move. For NPR News, I'm Johnny Kaufman in Atlanta.
The U.S. Embassy in Moscow says it must scale back its consular services after Russia imposed new staffing restrictions at diplomatic missions. Meantime, Terry Schultz reports from Brussels, tensions between the EU and Moscow are growing after Russia announced visa bans against 8 high-ranking officials.
The EU's top 3 leaders are blasting Russia's move, which includes blocking travel for the president of the European Parliament and a European Commission vice president. This action is unacceptable, lacks any legal justification, and is entirely groundless, the EU statement says, asserting that Russia has chosen confrontation with the EU and warning that the bloc may take appropriate measures in response. The Russian action comes a day after the EU legislature passed a non-binding resolution warning of consequences for the Kremlin's treatment of jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny, its military buildup on Ukraine's border, and attacks in the Czech Republic. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
A milestone in the U.S. fight against coronavirus. More than 100 million people in the country are now fully vaccinated against COVID-19. That's nearly 40% of the adult population. And as supplies continue to ramp up, the nation is entering a new stage in its vaccination campaign, trying to reach vaccine skeptics. The Biden administration is working to broaden accessibility, making shots available at doctors' offices and no-appointment walk-up sites. You're listening to NPR News. Texas is holding a special election today in the 6th Congressional District south of Dallas. More than 20 candidates are running to replace Representative Ron Wright, who died in February after contracting COVID-19. Former President Donald Trump has endorsed his widow, Susan Wright. If no one captures more than half of the vote, the top 2 finishers advance to a runoff. In Utah, federal land managers are offering a $10,000 reward as they search for the vandals who covered an ancient rock carving with racist words. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports indigenous rights groups are calling it a hate crime.
Federal land managers say they're working with conservators to scrub and remove the graffiti, a delicate endeavor because they're trying not to do any more damage to the prehistoric drawings. The vandals chose a place considered sacred to Native Americans known as Birthing Rock. It's in a popular hiking area near the Colorado River and the tourist destination of Moab, where it's peak season right now. Vandalism and theft of ancient artifacts has plagued Western lands for decades. Some ancient petroglyphs have even been removed from tourist maps to discourage visitors. In a statement, a Utah environmental group called Women of Bear's Ears said this crime was the result of neglect by the federal government to protect cultural resources. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
In Houston, police have launched a human smuggling investigation. They found more than 90 people huddled together inside a home. Police say they were responding to a call Friday about possible kidnapping when they made the discovery. It's unclear where the people are from or how long they were crowded in the home. I'm Amy Held in Washington. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, working together with communities to break down barriers and prepare all people for success in their jobs and careers as employees or entrepreneurs. More online at kauffman.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As you just heard in NPR News headlines, federal health officials said Friday that more than 100 million people in the United States had been fully vaccinated against the coronavirus, a milestone that represents almost 40% of the nation's adults. But concern continues to build among health officials over reaching more people who have not received their shots. What's the trend locally? Yesterday, WJFF's Patricio Rubio spoke to Dr. Bruce Elswick, medical director for Sullivan County Public Health and practicing physician at Crystal Run, for an update on vaccines and area vaccine clinics.
So I've had the privilege of working with the incredible staff and volunteers in administering the COVID vaccine to the citizens of Sullivan County. We've had our second remote pop-up clinic, and we've been very successful at getting people in to get their vaccines. Next week, we have one at the Strobel Center in Monticello. And on the 12th, we're back at the college and giving the Fieldhouse, administering second doses as well. So we're trying. We've given over 11,000 doses of vaccine to the citizens of the county so far.
We spoke to a couple of volunteers earlier this week. There were, you know, high praises of how the clinics were run. Can you give us your perspective on those SUNY Sullivan clinics?
It's been incredibly efficient. We've been blessed with volunteers and public health staff serving the community. We also have had the opportunity with the staff. The Sheriff's Department has helped out with this. The student nurses in the program at SUNY Sullivan have been incredibly helpful. We've given them the opportunity to administer the vaccine under supervision, and it gives them an opportunity to improve their clinical skills as well.
Now, I'm reading some reports that there's some people who are not coming back for their second dose. I'm not sure if you have the answer for that, but are you seeing that yourself?
Very few people haven't returned for their second dose. And what we've done is we followed up with phone calls and rescheduled some of the people who haven't turned up for their second doses. Most of the time it's because of concurrent illness or some other interfering factor rather than a desire not to get the second dose. However, you're absolutely right that people across the country have been somewhat resistant to getting the second dose. And I believe, unfortunately and inaccurately, they're believing they're immunized with one dose and they don't need the second dose. But I strongly recommend that everybody comply with the CDC recommendations that two doses are absolutely necessary to improve the immune response and protect our people from getting COVID.
I had earlier in the week Dr. Moore from Weill Cornell Medical School, and we were talking about what's happening in India and how the variant is sort of running rampant there and how fast it gets spread in a crowded city. So we're looking, hopefully, he suggested, obviously, of course, like same as you, get the vaccination so that doesn't happen here.
Absolutely. The unvaccinated people act as a opportunity for the virus to mutate The virus doesn't exist without a host, and in that host, the virus replicates or repeats itself, that's where the errors occur in the repetition and the recreation of the virus, and variants and mutations develop. And this is why it's so very important that as many people as possible get vaccinated so that we don't provide the opportunity for the virus to change.
Once you're fully vaccinated, and it has been 2 weeks after your second dose, I believe that's when you're fully vaccinated, what can you do and what can't you do?
Well, in our current environment, I still recommend that people wear their masks, socially distance, and certainly hand washing and using the precautions they have. The CDC has come out with recommendations that if you're in an environment with other totally vaccinated people, then you do have the opportunity to socialize. I have personally opted not to go into restaurants or expose myself to people that I don't know whether or not they're vaccinated, and to limit the exposure that I have, since I'm exposed in giving the vaccine or in being present at the clinics to literally thousands of people who haven't been vaccinated. So I don't want to take the opportunity that even though I'm fully vaccinated to harbor the virus and give it to someone who isn't vaccinated. So I'm still exercising fairly stringent precautions personally, and as my wife is as well.
Basically following the same steps that we were doing before the vaccine, just to keep safe, the social distancing, mask wearing, washing hands. Now, I'm very nervous about the virus, so I wear a double mask. I wear the K95 mask, and I wear a cloth mask with a filter in there. Am I overdoing it? Is double masking too much?
I don't think it's too much. I think that every precaution that you can take, as long as it doesn't interfere with your ability to breathe, I think it's very important to use an appropriate mask. And there, double masking is recommended in some situations for sure. But I think that it's every precaution is a wise precaution at this point. Now, as I mentioned before, the CDC and the president came out this week and modified the CDC recommendations to allow family gatherings if people are fully vaccinated and if you're not exposed to people who are unvaccinated and vulnerable for severe disease. So I would follow the guidelines that the CDC and the government has issued. There are certainly conflicting reports out there, but I tend to be rather conservative with my approach to exposing people and being exposed, even though I'm immunized. I would love to take a vacation, but I have not.
Yeah. especially after this year, especially you with, you know, you're being on the front line of this pandemic. One thing I'm nervous about, I have a young child, I have a 2-year-old who's obviously not vaccinated, and we don't know when the child vaccine will be available. And since both parents, me and my wife, are vaccinated, is it possible that we can carry the virus to our daughter, us not knowing that we have the virus, if we go out and expose us or we get exposed or something like that? Can we bring it home to her? Is that possible?
I believe that it is possible. It's very unlikely, but it is possible. And fortunately, most children who get sick, get the virus, don't get incredibly sick. There are cases, as you are aware of severe illness in children. But children can be also a vector for changing the virus as well if they have the virus in their system. So, again, exercising caution and being careful about having the child exposed. I know the schools are opening or have opened, and this is an opportunity for the virus to spread. But so far, I hope and pray that we don't have a major recurrence among young people and children. Children and adolescents over 16 can get vaccinated now in New York, and they should. We're dealing with issues now with children as far as activities at school, sports, participating in graduation and proms and other social events that schools normally have. It would be wonderful if we could return to some form of normalcy for the children who desperately need the education and the socialization that schools provide. But we still have to exercise caution and being incredibly careful for the children and for the adults.
Right, definitely. It's been a very trying year for students, parents, and teachers. I know of a situation that a whole family got infected. And it seems like some people got very severe. The parents are in the hospital. But the children who are older, those sick in 40s, are not as bad. Why does it affect other people worse than others? Is it underlying conditions? Is it just age?
I think it's multifactorial. Certainly underlying conditions predispose people to getting severe illness. And also age may be a factor. But our immune systems are very complex. And how we react to the virus really is an individual response. I have elders in my practice that have had the virus and have had very little effect, and I've had those that unfortunately have ended in the hospital and been on ventilators, and spouses who have not, and who have weathered the storm at home without getting any serious complications. So it's very much an individual thing about how we fight our viruses, and it's an unknown. It's certainly people with complex illness and people who have underlying illness are much more vulnerable to severe disease.
And just going back real quick before we end, about, you know, what you can't do and you can do after you're vaccinated, you can still get sick. Is that true? It just won't be as severe.
That's absolutely right. And as you know, the vaccines are incredibly effective, 95% for some of them. That still leaves 5% of people that can get sick from the virus, and usually it's much less sick and not requiring a ventilator, and the likelihood of a severe disease and death is almost nil in some of the vaccinated patients.
All right, which is it's good to hear. Anything else that we haven't spoken about that you want our listeners to know?
I think that continuing to be careful, listen to the reports from the CDC, follow the recommendations that are out there, get vaccinated. There are many people out there that I've seen that are against vaccination for a variety of reasons, and some of them are listening to social media or listening to reports that have no science behind them. We know that this is a very safe, all these vaccines are very safe. There has been some controversy with the J&J vaccine as far as blood clots in young women, but still the likelihood of being struck by lightning is greater than the likelihood of having a bad reaction to any of these vaccines, and the likelihood of having a severe complication and death, or spreading the virus, or allowing the virus to live in your body and mutate, is much greater than the very small possibility of having a reaction to the vaccine.
We were talking to Dr. Bruce Elswick, Medical Director for Sullivan County Public Health and practicing physician at Crystal Run in Rock Hill. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. I do really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, and be safe and be careful out there.
This is Patricio Robayo for WJFF Radio Catskill.
When we come back, cake art. This is Radio Chatskill. We'll be right back.
Donna Fellenberg here. Please join me this Saturday on Catskill Character when my guest will be Brian Heinle of Coshecton Center, New York. Brian's going to talk about volunteerism, community service, give us a history of the Heinle General Store and his family that's been here for generations. That's this Saturday on WJFF.
New releases are the lifeblood of folk music. And next time on the Wagaloda Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on WJFF Radio Catskill, we catch up with a whole hour of new music. Join me, please, for an hour of new British and Irish folk music next Sunday afternoon at 3 on the Wagaloda Monkeys.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Coming up on Thursday at the E.B. Crawford Library in Monticello, award-winning artist, food artist, and cake artist Kim Simons will teach folks how to take their cookie and cake decorating to the next level with a virtual workshop. You may have heard of Kim. She's a bona fide cake star, appearing on multiple Food Network shows and cake demonstrations around the country. Turns out it was a quick trip to food fame.
Well, cake design for me was watching TV, and I decided that, you know, I think I could do that. So I started freeze framing all the shows and looking for the products they were using so that I can figure out what I need to go out and buy and play with to learn how to be a cake artist.
Wait, you stopped your DVR and wrote down what the product was and went out and found it?
Yeah. I went down to the city to the New York Cake Company and bought everything I thought I needed, and I started playing. And within 6 months, I entered my first cake show, not knowing anything about the cake world at all. And I entered as a beginner, which is where my qualification I fell in. And I got bumped up to professional, and I won first place.
Wow.
Then the next show, I won first place, but also best division, and then best in show. And then I did it again and again. Within a year and a half, I was a master level cake artist.
That is amazing. Did you ever think that you would get to that level so quickly?
No, I didn't even think. I thought they were going to like throw my cake out and say, oh, you goofed up here, or you didn't follow the rules or something. You know, I was like, I had no clue what I was getting into.
You mentioned about the cake world. What is the cake world like, and what are the sort of nuances of that for people who may not know, like yourself, going into it?
Well, the fun part about the cake world is that anybody can join. We have, they have like cake shows, they call them, where they're around the United States, around the world, actually, where you can enter, anybody can enter. Children can enter from, you know, and then beginners up to professionals to masters. And you get to meet all the TV professionals, you know, the people who've been on TV, some judges, but we also help each other and teach each other how to get better. And since COVID, what we're doing now is lives. Actually, I have one today. I do lives where I teach people from home here. They can follow and learn and learn how to do something new with a different product that we're working with.
Now, you're known as the cake artist who is allergic to cake. Is that right?
Yeah. I'm gluten intolerant, so I can't eat anything that I make. No cookies, no cake. So what I did was I put together a cookbook on gluten-free cakes. Actually, I have appetizers through main dishes in my cookbook. It's like Get All Cookie with Kim Simons.
Well, how does that work in terms of taste? I mean, you know, a lot of what chefs do or cooks do, bakers do, is, you know, they make sure they taste their food, and you're not able to do that. So you're going with your gut?
No, I actually have my husband, who's my taste tester. And I always throw the extra cake, whatever I have, because you always cut off the tops of the cake, or when you're carving, you always have leftovers. So I call it cake in a bag, and I take it around to as many people as I can. And I'm like, all right, tell me what you think. So they kind of love when cake in the bag comes around.
So it is a community of in the cake world.
Yes. The cake world community is, we're like family. We actually really, really miss each other. But anytime you work on a show together, a cake show, like where you're in the event, like an expo type cake show, you can't wait to see each other. It's like a family reunion. And once you work on a TV show together, if you're a teammate, you're like friends forever. It's just such a close relationship for all of us. We miss each other so much right now.
And you have been on cake shows, on TV, on the Food Network. You've done demonstrations at some of the biggest venues in the United States, but you have a local connection here. Can you tell listeners about that?
Well, locally, I grew up in Liberty, New York. My father went to Liberty, and his sister, all my siblings went to Liberty. So I'm a Liberty girl, Sullivan County girl.
Taught by a local artist, C. Leland Parks. What did Mr. Parks teach you?
Well, he was the best art teacher ever. I mean, still, I'm since COVID, I miss because I haven't seen him. I usually see him every year. He recognized in me my talent, and he also recognized that I kind of liked to do things my own way, and I learn a little different. And he would just offer me different mediums and just give me a little bit of guidance and pushed me into being the artist that I am. And he's a wonderful artist, too. He does beautiful, beautiful watercolors.
Do you think of what you're doing as art? You said you're an artist, and do you think that people associate what you do with food and cake as art, or are there some misperceptions there?
Oh, no, actually, I'm pretty much known as like the artist in the cake world. Most of my stuff is artistically twisted a little bit. I don't do the traditional kind of cakes. I don't think I've really ever did a traditional wedding cake, the white wedding. Everything has to have some kind of artistic value to it, or different colors or sculptures, just something a little bit off.
In addition to doing cakes and food, you're an artist who participated in the 1969 Woodstock Festival 50th anniversary by painting those doves that are all around the county. You painted a few of them. Can you tell us about the ones that you did and sort of what those interpretations were?
Yeah, I painted 4.5 of them. The first one was Hector's Inn, and that I would say it hits the mark of the 50th anniversary. That one's the most hippie-ish and, you know, kind of hits Woodstock the most. Then I did one for Maurice Gary in Ferndale, which was me. He kind of just said, I want it to be beautiful. I don't want any peace signs or words on it. Just make it beautiful. And that was nature, just pure nature, because I love nature. She's my favorite artist, actually, Mother Nature. And then I did Roscoe Beer, half of that one, the side where the fish is playing the guitar. I did Liberty in Liberty, New York. That just represents Liberty. And I also did Wurtsboro outside the community church, which represents the D&H Canal and, you know, the Wurtsboro history.
Cool. Now, what was your reaction to the doves? And how does that compare with some of the reaction to some of your cakes?
It seems like they just love what I do. I have, like, a lot of followers who just can't wait to see what I post, whether it's a painting, a portrait, a mural, dove, cake, sugar, chocolate. They just look forward to seeing what I put out there.
And you've got this event coming up at the E.B. Crawford Library on May 6th at 6 p.m. It's painting with royal icing on fondant. So what can folks learn at this event?
Well, what you'll learn is how to use the royal icing. You can use it in many different ways. So I'll show like different versions of what you use. Most people use it for cookies, or they decorate wedding cakes, some, you know, intricate detail. And also they use it for gingerbread, like putting it on gingerbread, but you can paint with it. And I'm going to show like some colors, some products that you can use that are out there that are wonderful, and how to get creative with it on top of fondant. But what I do on the fondant, they can do on a cookie or on a gingerbread or on a cake. You could do it anywhere. The technique could be used on any medium.
I mean, with the popularity of the Great British Bake Off and the enduring Food Network shows, have you seen an increase in interest in your events and your live events that you're doing?
Yeah. I mean, especially now, because everyone's home and they're watching more TV than they ever used to. But there's a lot of young children who really want to get into it. And I would want to start having some classes again so that I can teach them the basics of, you know, cake art and art and, you know, being proud and have something in your back pocket that you can do, you know, anytime, anywhere.
You know, during the pandemic, a lot of people went to baking and you know, did a lot of that. Are you tired of baking at home, or is it just part of what you do?
No, I'm not tired. I mean I actually play with something every day. We just had the kitchen done over so that it was roomier and worked a little bit better. And I practice all the time, because I also have an article each month where I do a tutorial in the River Reporter as well. It's called Kim's Kitchen. So I'm constantly coming up with new things for the next month's Kim's Kitchen.
Excellent. And then this virtual event, Painting with Royal Icing on Fondant, is May 6th at 6 p.m. And there's more information at the E.B. Crawford Library's website, ebcpl.org. And Kim, where can folks follow you? Your Instagram or your website?
Well, I have my website. It's cakesbykimsimons.com. I'm also on Facebook, so it would be Kim M. Simons, and Instagram, Kim M. Simons. They can follow me on all of them.
Kim Simons named one of the top 10 cake artists by Dessert Professional magazine and award-winning artist, food artist, cake artist, and dove artist. Kim, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was so much fun. Thank you.
Coming up next, the student journalists of Manor, Inc. take over with Radio Chatskill Teen Edition. Stay with us.
Support comes from Rourke Law, Liberty, New York. A general law practice serving the Catskills and Delaware River Valley with an emphasis on estate planning, estate administration, elder law, and real property matters. RourkeLaw.com.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Eddie Lundquist, Associate Editor of Manor, Inc. Manor, Inc. is the youth-driven, community-supported monthly newspaper published by the Livingston Manor Free Library, and today we will be bringing you some of our stories. On today's show, Demi Budd talks to Sullivan County Nutrition Coordinator Stacy Marks about support to those struggling with food insecurity. Winter Sager goes to the mat with martial arts instructors Annie and Ian Constable. Plus, Page Turners, my latest book review. Food security is a right that many people do not have. In just 1 year alone, from 2019 to 2020, roughly 5 million more households are receiving SNAP, or Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, benefits. This program provides assistance in purchasing healthy food and maintaining food security in families, and also offers nutrition education. But how is this done, and what does this program mean for people in Sullivan County, especially in times such as the pandemic? To find out, Manor, Inc.'s Demi Budd spoke with Stacy Marks, the Nutrition Outreach and Education Program Coordinator for Sullivan County.
What exactly do you do as the NOEP Coordinator?
Well, first let me explain what the NOEP Coordinator means and what that stands for. NOEP means the Nutrition Outreach and Education Program. So in other words, I assist people in Sullivan County about the benefits of having SNAP, helping them in applying for SNAP. I reach out to the community people in the community who are food insecure. I tell them about the SNAP program. And then if they're interested in applying, I can help them from just giving them the information on how to apply or follow through with them through the whole process of the application.
So what exactly are SNAP benefits?
SNAP benefits means Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. So the goal of SNAP is to provide assistance in purchasing food so that you can maintain a healthy diet, increase food security, and provide nutrition education. They do this by making fresh fruits and vegetables and proteins available to people who may not have the means to buy them otherwise. They do this through access of an EBT card, which is similar to looking to a credit card so that it is discreet. And then you can purchase specific foods on that card with that card.
I'd read that they were formerly known as food stamps. Was there... any reason why the name was changed?
Well, back in 2008, the agricultural secretary, Ed Schaefer, changed the food stamp program to SNAP. So as a result of the Food Conservation and Energy Act, or better known as the Farm Bill, their goal was just to encourage the purchase of healthy foods, mm-hmm. SNAP.
In general, from what you've seen, what are some common factors that you think lead to food insecurity?
Well, I think the common factors are pretty, they're pretty consistent throughout all of the counties, especially with the pandemic. A significant amount of people lost their jobs during the pandemic, or at least had their hours cut doing their jobs, with businesses having so many restrictions on whether they can be open or not. Employees were finding themselves more in need of support than ever. So the amount of people without jobs increased. Mm-hmm. And food security has increased with it.
Do you know any general factors other than like loss of jobs that have led to it?
I think it really kind of depends on the economy of the area, mm-hmm. that you're in as well. I mean, unfortunately, some counties have, a better economic they're more economically stable than other counties are. Yeah. So different counties need different things. And Sullivan County is one of those counties that just need the extra help.
So how do people apply for SNAP benefits?
So people can apply for a few ways. First, I encourage them to give me a call so that I can ask them a few quick questions and give them a quick pre-screen. This process, quick, it gives us an idea if they're potentially eligible for SNAP. Now, I'm not the one that decides whether they get SNAP or not. The Department of Social Services does that, but I just help them with the application. So if we find that they're potentially eligible, then they can do a few things. I can give them a list of the basic things that they'll need to apply. And then I can give them the paper to a paper application to apply on their own. They can go online and apply, or they can make an appointment with me. And then I bring them to my office in Monticello. And then I walk them through the whole step. And then I can even mail it for them. So some people can't afford a stamp. Mm-hmm. Some people don't have access or a car to drive to a post office. So if they come to me, I can do everything that they need. And then it's easy as that.
I know you're not the one who decides if they get approval, but do you know the criteria for it?
Well, the main criteria is your income. But there are other things that come into factor with that. So mostly their cost of living. So if they're in, if they have income, but their cost of living is more than what their income is. So it, you know, that varies. But the income is their the main category.
Going back to COVID-19 and how that's affected food insecurity, do you have any statistics or just general?
Well, I think there's roughly 5 million more households receiving SNAP benefits in 2020 than 2019.
Oh, wow.
We don't have the statistics yet for 2021 because it's too early yet, mm-hmm. But it's about a 20% increase in people that are seeking benefits.
Wow.
Yeah.
How do you think SNAP benefits can assist families during times like this?
Well, I think it just provides people with assistance in purchasing healthy foods to help alleviate food insecurity. But there are other benefits too that come with SNAP. So if you apply for SNAP and you're approved for SNAP, then you get approved for other programs as well. So for example, if you get approved for SNAP benefits, then you can apply for free or reduced lunch through school. And there are other programs like WIC and HEAP that also, you know, can open doors for other programs as well.
If you don't mind sharing, what was your personal motivation for becoming coordinator?
Well, I know a lot of people that have benefited from using SNAP benefits. And I know plenty of people that really could have used it and didn't. Mm-hmm. So SNAP is a really great resource to use if you need it. And many people don't take advantage of it. So whether it be for misconceptions of SNAP or the stigma that is tied to SNAP, many people don't think that they're eligible for SNAP because they make too much money, but they don't know unless they try. So that's my motivation. Plus, I grew up in Livingston Manor, so it's rewarding for me to work in Sullivan County and, you know, help the people around my hometown.
Yeah, it's really nice.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Eddie Lundquist, Associate Editor of Manor Inc. Subakdo is an art and form of self-defense that is over 2,000 years old. It teaches a philosophy of discipline, respect, and oneness with nature. The philosophy embraces 8 key concepts, and it also promotes individual and social harmony. This ancient martial art form has always been a part of the lives of Annie and Ian Constable, and they spoke to Manor Inc.'s Winter Sager about it.
What got you started in martial arts?
So I started martial arts when I was 8, and I joined because my brother actually had an interest in martial arts. He is a couple years younger than me, so he had just turned 7 at the time. And after a month probably of sitting on the side, I was bored. So I decided to go take class with him rather than just sit and watch. Ian, I know, started when he was 4.
I started when I was 4 and a half years old. Same situation. My brother was older than me, and he was starting. He started at 7 years old, and I couldn't wait to get in there when I was three. So I was already punching and kicking outside the door, and then my instructor, Joe Papo, asked me to just get in there at 4 years old. First thing I did was run in and punch him in his groin.
A great entrance.
What is the name of the martial art we are talking about?
You're ready to write it.
Okay.
Su Bak Do Mu Duk Kwan. Su is S-O-O. Bak, B-A-H-K. Do, D-O. And then Mu Duk Kwan, M-O-O, D-U-K, K-W-A-N. And it's a traditional Korean martial art.
The art itself was created by Grandmaster Huang Ki. I don't know. Don't ask me how to spell it, but I'm pretty sure my wife knows how to spell it.
You could double check any spelling you want.
The dates, do you want to help me out with the dates, hon?
November 9th, 1945. Is that correct? Yep.
Yes.
Okay.
November 9th, 1945. It was created in Korea. The grandmaster at the time was, I don't know how old he was, I think he was like 9 years old when he first saw martial arts, and he wanted to learn how to defend himself. It was basically a military man just defending himself by, I think it was five thugs trying to rob him, and that started his interest. From there, he started reading books and learning all the martial arts from different styles and then put them together to create Su Bak Do Mu Duk Kwan.
He was seven, because I fact checked that one because I had a feeling it was a little bit younger, but he was seven.
He then taught his current son, who is our current grandmaster. But that, I have to say that our art is really the influence to other martial arts in the area. So it's basically the founding art for Taekwondo, Tangsudo, and some other arts that are in the area. It's not like I want to say we're the best. I'm just trying to say that it's the more influential art in the world, to be honest with you.
He did, when he was trying to put together Su Bak Do, which had an original name, but I forget the name that came before Tangsudo. He had a number of influences. So he had studied Okinawan karate. He had influences from both China and Japan, because I believe Korea was occupied by the Japanese in that time. Yes. So his school opened up at the close of World War II. Can you verify that, Ian?
I can't. I'm on the road.
No, I just meant from your knowledge.
No, I think you're talking about the
Korean War. His first school.
Oh, yeah, you're right. During the Second War, World War, I believe. I think it was during, and then at the end of it, actually.
So that period of time in history with the occupation and the borders moving back and forth between which army was controlling the area led to a lot of outside influences. So he had studied martial arts, a variety of martial arts that came together to form Su Bak Do. You guys are testing our history knowledge here.
That was awesome. That was really impressive what you guys pulled out there.
I would have no idea about that.
So then after he created the art, he started teaching his son. And that was during mostly the Korean War. And that caused a lot of strife because Japan had a major influence in the area at the time. And I don't know the name of the general, but at that time, the general told the grandmaster that he needed help in the military training his army, self-defense, and martial arts. After a certain amount of time, he then told the grandmaster that he was no longer allowed to teach martial arts in the public. So his son continue teaching in Korea. So that made the grandmaster decide to tell his son to become a philosopher and study and be more intelligent, and sent his son also across seas to teach the martial art over the world. So he sent his son to Switzerland, Spain, all over Europe pretty much, and then to Argentina, Chile, and Mexico, and then the United States. So that's how the art spread all over the world, is by his son mainly. He had a few other influential students that helped his son along with that. So I shouldn't say his son was the main person that did all that, but he had a few
higher ranking students as well.
Right. Then his son was here in New York, and they all had a big conference. And that's when the United States Federation was created. And the Grandmaster came here for that, and they did it at the World's Fair Hotel, or wherever that is, where they have the World's Fair. It's in all those movies with the big globe and out in the city. I don't know what the name of it is. The World's Fair, that area, but it's the conference room in that. And there's a picture of it in, I believe, the Hurleyville Museum.
I think so. I don't know where it is, but I know what you're talking about.
the Hurleyville Museum has actually the picture of the Grandmaster and everybody in that meeting their display, which is pretty awesome, because it was there. And I believe there was a big tournament. The first Nationals was held in the Concord in Sullivan County. So that's a big step for the United States in this area.
Definitely is like the traditional Korean martial art. I guess it's kind of, I feel like we circumvented that a lot, but the root of it.
What are your ranks wise in the martial art? Sorry, I was blanking on the word.
It's okay.
We're both
S-A, and then spelled like Dan, and that's a fourth degree black belt, at which point you're considered a master in our art.
We are both also Sa bombs. So we're the bomb, but I mean, we're master instructors. So it's very hard. It's a different, it's not a term, but it's different.
Credential,
yeah.
You can become a sadan. You can get your fourth degree black belt without becoming a master instructor. So it's kind of a different track, and there's different requirements along the way. You have an assistant instructor, a head instructor, or like a one who's capable of leading class and testing students. And then you have the master instructor. And there's a lot that goes into that.
Sabam also means preacher, teacher, philosopher, correct?
Not philosopher. Preacher, teacher, student, practitioner.
There you go. Practitioner. That was the last one. I knew it was a P.
Philosopher works.
How would you recommend for somebody who wants to get involved to get involved in martial arts?
In any martial arts, you're just going to reach out to a school and say you want to try it out. Depending on which direction you want to go, that's just on your choice. I mean, there's mixed martial arts now that everybody's trying to go to, but you don't have dedication or the traditional martial art where you have a lot of dedication to yourself on one specific art.
Don't be afraid to take the first step, because that is the hardest one. We have these 8 key concepts, which are kind of the guiding principles of the art. And the very first one that you teach students is called Yung Gi, which means courage. So taking that first step to just cross the tape, we say, because we have the tape at the edge of the dojang, to go across that tape and become not just a spectator, but a participant in the activity. That's what you need. Just get yourself across the tape, and then you'll probably end up finding it is for you.
What would you say is your favorite part?
Teaching or practicing or?
In general.
My favorite part about it all would be that we all become like a family in the end. We know people all over the world now through it, and some good, some bad, you never know. But we have a good experience with them all. We all meet at some point.
I know I gotta one up you. So for me, it'd be that my family literally came to me through Sue Bakhto. Ian and I met through Sue Bakhto. Our two kids are, you know, a result of that relationship. And when I think about even other aspects of my life, my job has been impacted by that. Where I live has been impacted by that. And then that kind of extended family in quotations that he's talked about. So it really is all aspects of the immediate family to the outside social circle has been influenced by it. And just, I think who you are as a person changes as well, whether you're starting as a child or an adult, it's impacted.
How was your Academy in Liberty? Like, how did you start that? Or did you start that?
Like, I did not start it. Okay. I did not. I took it over. Okay, so the Liberty Moodle Quant Academy was started in 1991 or two, I believe. And he was running the school for Master Hong in Tang Sido originally. Tang Sido was the name before Su Bak Do, and the grandmaster didn't realize that there was an original name to the art. So the grandmaster adapted the name of the art to Su Bak Do later after it already naming it the first time. My instructor had a falling out, and Master Hong had a falling out with the Federation of our art. And so Master Hong left, and my instructor was left deciding if he wanted to stay with the art or go his own way following Master Hong, who created his own art. So Sarong Papo decided to stay, opened up the school, and had a few students, which were four families, I guess you would say. And I was one of the family members that stayed with him. With my family, my brother and my mother were in the art. And so now we're here to this day, present day.
What are some benefits that students can receive from martial arts?
I would say depends, you know, everybody has their own benefits from it, and it's multiple benefits, to be honest with you. Some kids, you know, mental stimulant they get from doing martial arts is good for them so that they can concentrate more. Again, going back to the geeky concepts would be Chung Shin Tang Il is concentration. So, you know, the kids get concentration, they get another sense of history, they get tradition, they get a little bit of philosophy and a little bit of respect and tradition. And those are five key values of the art too that we concentrate on.
I also say self-confidence and self-discipline. Working in schools, those are things that, you know, it's kind of the opposites, but you find a lot of kids are missing either one or the other. So having the confidence that, whether it's physical or mental, that they can handle it, especially when things get tough, that they can persevere through that. So I guess perseverance would be another one there. On the flip side, you have the kids that need that self-discipline, who need to learn how to focus on something, but also how to listen and follow directions. But then you also have the physical activity, which some kids just need movement, along with the friendships that they gain.
It's a great way to get out of the county, out of the area. And kids, you know, when they start, they don't realize that they can be involved in bigger things in life.
Mm.
And this is one good way to create leaders in the community and take themselves out into the world. That's something that we try and focus on, is getting the kids out and getting new experiences in life. And, you know, we also have other organizations within our organization that help kids that aren't able to pay for certain events that we go to. And it's a hard process to go through to get the money for it. But if they wanted to do it, there's ways that we can help them get that financial aid.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill Teen Edition. I'm Eddie Lundquist, Associate Editor of Manor, Inc. This month in my Page Turner's book review, One Hell of a Masterpiece.
I would not say that Dante's Inferno is an easy, nor really an enjoyable read for a lot of people. Personally, I had great interest in it, as I am an avid consumer of both horror and philosophy, both of which this story contains a lot of. There is so much to digest in this ancient writing, you can, and people have, spend your entire life studying, analyzing, and connecting the content within its pages. The epic poem follows Dante himself, who, in an attempt to escape creatures who would drag him to hell when he loses the path of righteousness, follows the Roman poet Virgil, one of his heroes and inspirations. Virgil tries to help by taking the long path through the circles of hell, both to demonstrate to Dante the horrors his sinful actions would bring him after death, as well as to help him escape the very same fate. As the duo descend down further, further, past each of the sin-related circles, each one with a separate gruesome punishment, they meet some inhabitants of each one, from indulgent citizens to lustful heroes to betraying biblical figures. The horrors only increase, terrifying Dante, as the reader sees what he sees in vivid detail that truly sends shivers down your spine. For example, in Canto 3, right before entering hell, Dante describes the lost souls along the river Acheron, stating, "Beyond all doubt that this was the dreary guild, repellent both to God and his enemies, hapless ones never alive, their bare skin galled by flies and wasps, blood trickling down the face, mingling with tears for harvest underfoot by writhing maggots. Then, when I turned my eyes farther along our course, I could make out people upon the shore of some great river." Such gut-wrenching imagery is prevalent in the story, making it polarizing for a recommendation. Some readers like that sort of thing, others do not. It does serve a purpose, though, to strike fear into the heart of the reader and to show them that sin will put you here. Considering the religious connections to Christianity, of course, I believe that it definitely succeeds in its goal. And, if you aren't interested in the religious part of this tale, it still holds up as a good read, but probably not the best bedtime story. I enjoyed it. At first, especially in Canto 1 and 2, it is very slow and is a hard change of pace in both content and execution. I refer to, of course, the outdated language and translation complications. But as soon as you can get past that, it becomes very easy, though a very large book to read. The copy I read was illustrated by Michael Mazur, with abstract pieces that only heighten the sense of paranoia and exhilaration that grows as you move on. The pieces grow along with the reader, making more sense as their mindset descends into hell and madness with Dante and his guide. With the illustrations setting the mood, another thing that makes reading Inferno less of a slog is reading out loud, even just whispering or making the forms of the words with your mouth. It helps you not to miss any lines, because if you do, you will be very, very lost very quickly. All in all, a great read. Very gruesome, but very enjoyable if you like thinking about existential terror for pleasure and enjoyment.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill Teen Edition. Special thanks to Robin Chavez, David Dan, Diana Fredenberg, Amy Heinz, and Art Steinhauer. You can find more information about Manor Inc. at manorinc.org. Radio Chatskill is produced in partnership with WJFF. I'm Eddie Lundquist. Thank you for listening.
Old School Session, James Brown Birthday Extravaganza,
James Brown and James Brown Productions,
Special
James Brown Birthday Celebration,
Special for you,
The Godfather of Soul, James Brown,
Birthday to the Godfather of Soul.
That's Selector Starkey, DJ Chex, and James Brown on Old School Sessions tomorrow night at 10.
And I sweat like James Brown in here, for real.
WJFF is your community radio station in whatever community you happen to be, thanks to the WJFF mobile app. Available for your Apple or Android device, the WJFF app lets you hear your favorite Catskill station anywhere in the world, from Monticello to Monte Carlo, from Honesdale to Honolulu, or just from your doorstep to downtown. Get the WJFF app from Google Play or the Apple App Store.
Coming up next, more great local programming on Radio Catskill. Farm and Country at 11, followed by Catskill Character, The Janice Adams Show at noon, and Staying Home with Josh Fox live at 1 o'clock. Today's forecast for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Temperatures nearly the same. It will get warmer, high near 56, 58 actually. Cloudy skies still overcast tonight, low 45. Partly cloudy tomorrow, and then in the afternoon, occasional showers or thunderstorms, a high near 70. This is WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.